WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The Karen Ann Quinlan case was the first major right-to-die case in America. Art Kaplan is a medical ethicist who has helped organize a conference on death and dying to be held this weekend in Princeton. It commemorates the 20th anniversary of the court decision that gave Karen Quinlan's parents the right to take her off a respirator. Kaplan is the director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of Moral Matters and is currently writing a book on how to manage ethical dilemmas in dying. I asked him what the impact of the Quinlan case has been on dying in America.
Prior to that case, if you were unconscious or incapacitated or couldn't speak, more or less, it was impossible to get life support stopped. When someone was on life support, when someone was getting aggressive medical therapy, the only way to have that stop is if the doctor decided that was enough. And sometimes they did, and sometimes they didn't. After Quinlan, the door opened to allowing families, friends, significant others to step in and make some requests and decisions and have them honored about stopping life support. It's important to know that there had been a tradition, and there still is down to this day, of letting competent people make decisions about stopping care. So you could have been, let's say, a Jehovah's Witness, an adult, and said, I don't want a blood transfusion, and that would have been respected. You could have been a Christian Scientist and said, I don't want to go into the healthcare system at all. Once in a while, I'd seen someone with diabetes who had a gangrenous leg in their 70s or 80s and said, I don't want this amputated, and went home and died. Quinlan was significant because all of the things I described involve competent adults. There had never been a court-based recognition of the right of someone else to decide for a person what was in their interest, what they would have wanted. There are lots of people in that situation who can't let you know their values, let you know their views. And so it really was the landmark case in moving from respect for individual choice for competent people over to trying to do something to respect the wishes and values of people who couldn't articulate them anymore.
Another landmark case after the Quinlan case was the Nancy Cruzan case. Nancy Cruzan was a young woman who was in a car crash.
Right.
And she was being kept alive by a feeding tube.
Correct.
She had been in what was called a vegetative state.
Permanent vegetative state.
Parents wanted to let her die and to take her off the feeding tube.
Right.
What did the court say, and how has that affected dying in America?
Well, the court looked directly back at Quinlan, and this case actually went to the Supreme Court. It's the only right-to-die case that has been up to the Supreme Court. And they noted that in Quinlan, family members who were close to the person who couldn't speak, who were incompetent, could step in and make a judgment about what was right to do. But the difference was this. The Quinlans said they knew what their daughter would have wanted. They'd had conversations, and she had indicated to them she wouldn't want to be kept alive if she became severely impaired, permanently unconscious. The Cruzan family said they'd never had this kind of conversation directly, and so it was a tougher issue. The first question that came up in the Cruzan case was, could a feeding tube be taken away? The second was, could you take it away if you didn't have a direct knowledge that that's what the person would have wanted? And the Supreme Court ruled, ultimately, a feeding tube is a medical technology, no different from a ventilator or any other medical technology, and can be removed. And if a family can say that they've had a close, intimate knowledge of who this person was, and there's no reason to disqualify them or think that they have some conflict of interest or heinous motive in trying to end this care, then they could step in on the grounds of best interest.
So how much power now does a family have to decide on the behalf of a loved one who's in a permanent comatose state whether the life support should be removed or not?
I think it's fair to say at this point in time in the United States, no one should worry about being imprisoned by technology in a coma because family members do have the right to speak for you. It basically divides in two ways. There's a set of people who might be unconscious or incompetent who once did have values and views and were persons and went about their business. Families can step in and make decisions for them when they become impaired. The tough cases, the place we still don't have consensus, is with children or someone who was born severely retarded and remains so. They've never said what they would want, and that's the gray zone about disconnecting life support at this point in time by substitutes or family members or surrogates. So for people who once were competent, I can say we've got ethical consensus, we've got legal consensus, we've moved from Quinlan to the present day to say others can speak for you and you can have your treatment stopped. But when it's someone who never was competent, a baby, that's still a matter of a lot of contention.
As a result of the Quinlan and Cruzan cases, a lot of people have started writing up living wills, specifying, you know, if I'm in a comatose state and there's no hope of recovery, please don't keep me alive on life support, et cetera, whatever you want to say in the living will. You recently, in an op-ed piece, declared the failure of the living will. I was very surprised to read that. In what respect do you think living wills are a failure?
They're really dead on arrival. I'm not against them, but they just haven't worked. What the courts did post-Quinlan and post-Cruzan was say, look, it would be better if when you're competent, if you could write out your wishes. That's the gold standard. If a family member or significant other knows what you would have wanted and you bothered to write it down, we can't have any doubt that that's what you would want. And if you want a lot of care, you'd get that. If you don't want care, it would be stopped. But the problem is really threefold. First, people don't like to write up recipes about how they're going to die. It's like it has all the attractiveness of buying funeral plots. Yeah, it's a good idea to do it. And yes, you wouldn't burden your family with the problem when you die. But a lot of folks think, yuck. Secondly, the system we have of healthcare is so disorganized, so poorly coordinated that even if you have a living will, let's say you get it and you go to the nursing home, but all of a sudden you're older, you have a crisis, you have a heart attack, you're rushed off to the hospital. Well, they don't necessarily go and get your chart and take it with you. All of a sudden it's separated from you, can't be found. In a system that doesn't have good primary care providers kind of being with you all the way through, the living will can easily be lost, misplaced, and never discovered. In fact, some people fill out a living will and give it to their lawyer. I keep laughing at that because the last person the doctor is going to call, litigious America, is your lawyer if you get sick or in a crisis. So the problems are people don't fill them out. They often get misplaced or lost. And even when you've got them, the fact is, if you haven't had a conversation with your family member and all that's there is a piece of paper, and yet Cousin Joe is afraid or upset and says, I think we should continue care. I'm not sure I can trust this. Well, doctors and nurses are human beings, too. They're going to respond more to a real live person than a piece of paper. And you can pass laws forever saying you must do what the piece of paper says. That's not the real world of human behavior. And they often will override a living will when someone says they don't want it honored.
Do you have one?
I do, but my wife doesn't. She and I have had lots of conversations, and she's in the camp that says, I think the whole thing's yucky and disgusting. You make decisions for me. I filled one out, but I know enough about the healthcare system that I know the crucial step is to have that conversation with the people who are going to be there should I get sick, my wife, my son, my other relatives, my friends. You need to have that family conversation.
Now, what about power of attorney? Do you have to officially designate a loved one as your voice if you are in a coma?
I think that's more important than actually filling out this recipe idea. If you think about it, today's medical care for seriously ill people, you'd almost have to take a crash course in medical school to fill out all the things that might be done to you. Do you know about blood pressure control and antibiotics and sensitive chemicals to control your kidney output? These living wills aren't going to give really the right kind of instruction to the healthcare provider, and it's hard to anticipate every twist and turn. If you designate someone as the decision maker and even an alternate in case they can't be there, I think you're much further down the road to retaining control and having your wishes respected. I think that's the crucial step, is to designate two decision makers. And I have to add one other little point. Ask them. Make sure you tell them that you've designated them. There are many people who simply designate them and don't tell them. And some people don't want to do it. They're afraid. They're overwhelmed by it. If you're going to pick your sister, if you're going to pick your brother-in-law, make sure you tell them and ask them, would you do this for me, and have some general discussion about what you would want. So that's the crucial step, picking this decision maker.
My guest is Art Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with medical ethicist Art Kaplan about living wills and the difficulty of deciding if a loved one should be taken off life support. How much have you come to trust family members with such a complicated decision? Do you think most people handle it with grace and responsibility?
Well, Terry, that's a good question. I'm in a funny position because a lot of the time when I get asked about a case, either at the University of Pennsylvania or someone calls up from somewhere around the country and is trying to figure out what to do in a contentious case, it's often with a family that's fractured or vulnerable or torn. They're trying to figure out what to do because one family member is saying do this and another one saying do that, and that's what makes for trouble. But I think my general impression is, despite those cases that I hear about or that in some ways we all hear about, most cases get worked out. Most families want to do the right thing by their loved one. Most families want to make sure that their loved one dies with dignity. I think one of the crucial problems that I've seen about how we die and losing control is this. If the doctors in the hospital, if the nurses put the question to family members, can we have your permission to stop? Is it all right with you? Or you have to give us permission before we back away. What sometimes happens is, in my experience, families get put in a weird position. They're being asked to give permission to kill their relative or their loved one, and they don't want to do that. You have to be careful, now that we've got the right to stop care, to present it in a way that doesn't load the family members with guilt. So what you have to say is, we're going to stop now. The time has come to stop now. You leave the issue open for the family to say, well, is that all we could do? Or I'm not sure that's the time. But you don't ask them to bear the guilt of saying, before we can stop, you must give us permission to disconnect this feeding tube.
But, of course, the medical profession doesn't really want that responsibility either, and that leaves them liable to lawsuits,
too. They hate it, but it's where it has to go. I think if I was looking at where we've come from Quinlan, say, in 20 years, mm-hmm. my field, bioethics, has done some good. It's given people more autonomy, more self-determination, more control, even when they become incompetent, and that's to the good. The danger is, by making medicine feel as if they can't do anything without explicit patient permission, it tends to put all the load of stopping care onto family members when the person can't speak. And you don't want to get it into a confrontational situation. Sometimes we make crises with families when we force their nose into the idea that they're going to pull the plug. The way to do it is to approach it gently with the presumption that it's okay or it's permissible. Another way to put it is this way. We had a case at Children's Hospital here in Philadelphia. Listeners will remember 2 years ago, the Lakeburg twins, and they were two twins that were conjoined Siamese twins, and they were going to try and rescue one of the twins through a desperate operation. And they went to the mother and said, you know, there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that this is going to work. It's experimental. We don't know what we're doing, but, you know, it's long odds. Well, what mother isn't going to take a 1 in any number chance? If you put it that way. And it's the same thing at the end of life. If you say that, well, there's only a remote chance that they can live longer, or there's a 1 in 1,000,000 chance that they're going to wake up from their coma, I think a lot of mothers, a lot of brothers, a lot of uncles are going to be saying, well, I can't in good conscience forego the one. I'm going to continue. And that's where the problems come. It's not so much that we haven't created room for choice or even given authority to families. Now we've got to work more on how we present the options to them so they don't feel coerced.
So are you working with people in the medical profession about how to present
that's
the
exactly
options
to families? That's exactly what I'm interested in now, and what the Center for Bioethics at Penn is interested in now is trying to figure out, can we do some studies that look more closely at how people communicate and how this information exchange goes around the termination of treatment issue? If you want to put it another way, we've carved out an abstract right. And the judges are happy, and to some extent the lawyers are happy, and we've got this kind of consensus point. But now in the real world of practice, when you realize the nuances that go into the communication, if you don't get that nailed down, if we don't teach the medical students how to ask and how to present it, and if we don't, in a sense, put the right literature out in the waiting room so that people are thinking, it's okay to let somebody go. I don't have to feel I didn't do everything for mom. I somehow am guilty that I didn't save my daughter. We've got to present all that information in a way that, yes, they have the choice ultimately, the family or the person speaking for the patient, but we're going to let them off in terms of feeling that they did what they could and they did the responsible thing.
Art Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's the author of Moral Matters. Tomorrow we'll talk with Kaplan about the future of dying in America.